Convened. It's Wednesday, April 1st, and it's about 6:32. And to get us started here in the evening session, Senate File 1828, we still have a quorum from this afternoon. Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 1828 is a simple bill we can do rather quickly, so I appreciate moving it up in the schedule. It asks for a lifetime license under spearing license, similar to other licenses that are existing out there under DNR already. A combination of lifetime angling and spearing license, and it goes through the different fees for the license. So I think it's pretty self-explanatory, and I don't know what questions we might have from the committee or DNR or whoever, but
I'm curious if Mr. Knopf,
Senator Shawbury.
Mr. Chair, I'm curious if Mr. Knopf has any kind of conformity questions.
Mr. Knopf, does this look like it's in order?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think it does.
Track with what we've got.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry, the only issue is whether or not the fees are appropriately set. Seems to be probably the biggest issue would be
Mr. Bogus, could you help us just look through the numbers a little bit there?
Mr. Chair and members, Ed Bogus, DNR, Division of Fish and Wildlife, and these look like the numbers that we had worked on. I just tried to catch Senator Jungbauer as we were convening here. The only issue that we see in the bill is on Section 4, where it's creating a sporting license fee. The way this is drafted, I think it's increasing all lifetime sporting licenses and adding adding spearing to them, and I think our recommendation would be that there be a separate lifetime sporting license with a spearing option, and that we keep the existing lifetime sporting license as is. So we just need to create a new section to do that. I think that was the author's intent, but this would actually replace the existing sporting license, and I don't think that was the intent.
Mr. Bogus, what would that be for a fee?
Mr. Chair, I think these fees would be the appropriate fees for a lifetime sporting license with a lifetime spearing option, and that we would go back to the stricken fees for the regular lifetime sporting license.
Yeah. Mr. Knopf?
Mr. Chairman, I think what Mr. Bogus is saying is you would leave the existing Subdivision 5 alone and create maybe a Subdivision 5A or whatever afterwards that would have this separate category for people to buy a lifetime sporting with a spearing option included. And then if these would be the new fees, and you would leave the old fees under the existing subdivision alone.
Senator Ingebretson, would you like to move that?
I would move that.
Senator Ingebretson moves that we create a Subdivision 5A to include the lifetime sporting license for those who wish to spear as an option. Questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
I'll move the bill.
Senator Chaudhry moves that Senate File 1828 as amended be recommended to pass. And do you want it sent to the floor?
It goes to finance. We have to check the numbers.
And referred to finance, I guess.
Is the whole game and fish bill going to finance?
Yes, you could put it in there.
I'll just lay it over then.
We'll lay it over, Senator, for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for moving me up. And I always try to be accommodating by doing my presentations very rapidly. Thanks.
And, Senator, most of the time you're right on.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senate File 1798, Senator Chaudhry. I guess it's your option, Senator. You've got two here. Would you like 1798 first?
To the bow fishing one.
Okay,
first.
1798 it is, bow fishing. Senator Chaudhry.
Mr. Chair, members, this would allow bow fishing at night. What the issue is that currently fishing with a bow and arrow, which is becoming a growing sport, currently has limitations on where you can fish. Currently, you can do it during the day, but a lot of the bow fishing for rough fish needs to occur at night. That's just a part of the sport, like a smelt run. but it's not allowed. The issue being primarily the need for lights and then the generators in the boat that need to run those lights. However, in this past year, the DNR authorized a small number of lakes to be allowed to be bow fished at night to see how it go. And there honestly were not very many problems associated with it. Primarily, what we learned is that if there were complaints from lakeshore owners, for example, there was a concern that poaching was going on, but that turned out not to be the case. And so what we've done is allow bow fishing to be conducted at night with restrictions on the lighting, the sound, distance from structures, et cetera. And I think that's reasonable. Most importantly, because we have an invasive species problem. We have a water quality problem that's caused in large part by rough fish. Whenever we've heard about turbidity in water, there's always a rough fish involved. And if we have people who are willing to pay us for the privilege of taking care of our invasive species problem, that impacts not only the Asian carp invasion or current carp invasion, but all of rough fish, and could improve our water quality, we shouldn't just let them, we should encourage it. And so that's what this bill would do. You can go to my first witness, Brian Peschel, with the Land O'Lakes Bow Fishing Association.
Brian Peschel, is it?
Peschel.
Peschel, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for allowing me to, giving me this opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Brian Peschel. I am the current president for Land O'Lakes Bow Fishing Association, and that is Minnesota's only bow fishing association. Bow fishing with artificial lights is not foreign to most ecosystems throughout the United States. Our neighbors in Wisconsin, Iowa, South Dakota currently have night seasons, very unrestricted. Almost all the bodies of water are open. They don't have any limitations to generators or lights, which we're seeking. And their seasons have been actually very successful. Back in January, I had an opportunity to speak with Mr. Tom Van Heren with the he's the regulation specialist for the Department of Natural Resources for Wisconsin and their enforcement division. I had an opportunity to talk to him about how things have gone for them since they've gone from the rule change process to actual law. And he said that things have gone very well. They have not seen, as far as the complaint level, it's within their normal satisfaction level, and they've had no lake associations seek complaints with him. So it's gone very well for them. As we're trying to stay here, night bow fishing dramatically allows us to increase our harvesting of rough fish. Rough fish come into the shallow waters in the evening for feeding purposes, and by doing so, they seem to be much calmer. During the day, they're very skittish. They're very difficult. Can be actually very difficult to try to fish. By using a night season, we're able to not only increase our level of harvesting, but it also helps us to identify fish. The fish now that used to be 10 yards out are literally 10 feet in front of us. They're not spooked. It gives us plenty of time to identify fish, to reduce any accidental-type shootings that would occur. In 2006, U.S. Fish and Wildlife requested a deal that it's called the Draft Management and Control Plan for Asian Carps in the U.S. And on page 81 and 82, it actually encourages night bow fishing as a viable harvest method towards a long-term goal of reducing populations. On smaller bodies of water that are a closed system, we can actually long-term could help reduce populations of rough fish, and mainly in space or invasive species such as the common carp and, again, now the Asian carp that are starting to show up in our river systems. As Senator Chaudhry mentioned, in 2008, we had a small selection of lakes under the rule change, and it was fairly successful. Some of the areas that did receive attention were due to kind of the unknown. People didn't know what was going on. They just seen a boat with a bunch of lights, and they weren't sure what the status was. So they would call the conservation officer, and they would find out that they were actually harvesting rough fish. Some of the areas that did have some legitimate complaints were more populated areas. I know Clearwater was a lake that was a concern, and a couple lakes up by Alexandria, which are more heavier populated lakes. And, of course, the higher density populations of people bowfish were in those areas. So that was a matter of more or less overcrowding. By opening up the state, we are allowing bow fishermen and women in the state to make proper choices and actually seek lakes that are more or less uninhabited. We're not about trying to run somebody's dock at 3 o'clock in the morning. We want to be able to choose those areas that don't have cabins and properties that are occupied. And again, in this bill, we've seeked protections for the property owners through some distance restrictions and then the decibel ratings, which are by far the most
restrictive.
Restrictive. Thank you very much, sir. Restrictive in the U.S. So we're sitting here today saying we believe in responsibility and we want this to work for everybody, not just us, but we also believe the property owners need to it needs to work for them also. So. And today, you know, the Minnesota DNR continues to see a decline in fishing licenses sold. Giving Minnesota fishermen and women additional opportunities can help grow the sport, can get new people into fishing, and provide additional opportunities for our youth to experience the great outdoors in Minnesota. We also feel that this will be very beneficial for retailers. With the sport growing, the product or the equipment that we're seeing today is becoming much more sophisticated along with a lot of hunting and fishing sports. Boats are becoming bigger and more expensive. I know a couple of individuals that probably have at least $25,000 into their dedicated bow fishing boat. My boat personally came out of, it's a custom-made boat out of Arkansas. I mean, we spend some money. And then on top of that, you're buying generators, you're buying lights, hunting and fishing equipment, marine equipment, life jackets, and all the safety stuff that goes along with it. So there, we believe there's an economic benefit to Minnesota retailers, which, again, will help tax money. So with that, in conclusion, I just want to say that back in 1998, Minnesotans overwhelmingly asked to have added to our Constitution the right to hunt and fish legally by law and regulation. And today we're just sitting here asking for those same opportunities that our fellow bow fishermen and women have across the U.S. I appreciate your time and giving me this opportunity, and I can certainly take any questions if you have any.
Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many bow fishers in the state?
The DNR did a question on the ESL system last year, and I believe it was 6250 or somewhere. It was over 6,200 that answered yes that they had bow fish. Now, on top of that, I know not everybody was asked a question. I certainly wasn't when I bought a license. So we feel that it's probably over 10,000 in the state. Most of your bow fishermen and women will do it in May and June are the most popular months. But as the sport's growing and it's becoming more popular, we're seeing more people that are switching over from traditional pole and fishing exercises to now bow fishing. Me personally, I haven't picked up a pole in 2 years. I know one individual in our membership actually was a huge bass tournament fisherman. Had the big Ranger bass boat. He's now a dedicated bow fisherman. He hasn't picked up a rod and reel last year.
Thank you. And just to follow up, Mr. Chair, my only concern was when this first came up, and I co-authored the bill, but was the idea of walleyes being in shallow. You don't see any of those at night, do you?
You'll see some.
Early in the season you would, but I know it's illegal.
Yeah, so. You'll see some, and absolutely. I mean, by no means, we harvest rough fish only.
Yeah.
We advocate that in one of the platforms you do at their tournaments is to educate people and let them know that the game fish are not to be harvested. Okay. The walleyes aren't as prevalent. You'll see a lot of panfish, some bass. But the beautiful thing about night fishing is you can easily identify fish.
Right.
It actually helps us to identify because the fish are not nearly as skittish, and it gives you plenty of time to make that choice.
And those eyes glow pretty good. In
it, yeah, exactly. They're very.
Not that I would know that. Yeah.
Mr. Petrel, do you typically go on rivers?
That's actually one of the things that we really like to see are rivers. Rivers, for the most part, have a lot of floodplains, so there's a lot of areas on rivers that allow us to do this without disturbing anybody. But on top of that, it actually gives us a wider range of species that we can harvest. By far, rivers are probably one of the most popular areas that we would like to see. And that's and one of the reasons we've seeked this bill or this opportunity.
And Mr. Knopf, would a dock be considered an occupied structure if someone was on it? Or?
Mr. Chairman, I would consider that an occupied structure.
You would? Okay. And I'm assuming your group understands that? Where people are, you're not really allowed.
We'll certainly make it available, and we'll promote this in every aspect of it. Absolutely.
Well, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senators. I'm Mark Morrison from Mankato. I'll probably hit some of the same points Brian made, and I don't know if any of you know a lot about bow fishing, but if you have any questions, just feel free to ask me, because it's a fairly relatively unknown sport, but it's growing. It's probably the highest growing segment of archery.
Feel free to give a little summary or background on what it is.
Yeah, basically, you know, bow fishing is the harvest of rough fish with a bow and arrow, and it started probably back in the 30s and 40s when Fred Bear started the first seasons in Michigan. And, of course, it's grown in popularity because the number one species of fish to shoot with a bow and arrow is the common carp, which I don't know if any of you know, or most of you probably know, is an invasive species of fish that was brought over here from Europe and does a lot of damage. So with the spread of the carp, the sport of bow fishing has gone up pretty much exponentially. So like I said, it's been done for 50, 60 years, and now Minnesota is a good place to do it because the number of lakes we have and the water quality we have compared to some areas. But the carp are doing a lot of damage to the lakes, and we, as bow fishermen, if we're allowed to do this at night, we can remove large numbers of these fish, as Brian said and the Senator said, at no cost to the DNR. For instance, just from my experience, we have, when we worked with the DNR and we got these 73 lakes, I was lucky enough in my county to have 5 lakes I could bow fish on at night. Now, most of the guys in our club and throughout the state, they don't have that many lakes in their area, thus there's some overcrowding. But anyway, in my experience, I went out approximately 40 nights out of the 90 possible, and I kind of kept track, and I shot a little over 4,000 pounds of rough fish in that time. And, you know, it could have been more. I just stopped when my 100-gallon barrel in the boat was full. So that's a lot of habitat-destroying rough fish like carp that are taken out of the lakes just by me. And I never saw another bow fisher the entire time I was doing that, and not one time in those 40 nights. So, you know, if you put a couple more boats on there, obviously you're going to take out a lot more fish, and you're going to help clean the water up.
Mr. Morrison, was there quite a fish fry then the next day? Or?
Yeah, well, not in some aspects. Some of the fish, like, say, the gar fish, those are pretty good eating fish. Those we eat. A lot of the buffalo and carp we give to smokers, and frankly, a lot of them go into, you know, a ravine at the farm or get put in a farm field and buried as fertilizer, basically.
I see in the bill there are restrictions about not leaving the fish behind.
Yeah, you cannot leave fish on the waters or on the shore of a public waterway or private anywhere. You have to dispose of them properly. And that's something that we as a club, we have a pretty progressive club. Matter of fact, of all the bow fishing clubs in the nation, I would think that ours is probably the most progressive, because we have sought to put restrictions on ourselves as far as the noise that the generator can output. Our decibel level is a lot lower. Right now it's 84 decibels at, I think, 50 feet, and that's the DNR's rule for watercraft, where we have stipulated 67 decibels. So we've, you know, greatly diminished the amount of noise. And we put restrictions in there about where you can be with your lights, because people are going to have concerns, you know, about lights shining on their property, about noise, and the DNR is probably going to have concerns about, you know, the accidental shooting of, or non-accidental shooting of game fish. But in my experience of these 40 nights bow fishing, I didn't have one complaint, not one DNR, sheriff, police officer, nobody was called in those 40 nights. That adds up to a lot of hours on the water. And every lake homeowner that I ran into was obviously for it, because we were, what they want out of the lake, we're taking out of the lake. And some lake associations have gone so far in Wisconsin, because they saw the success there, to pay you 50 cents a fish you take out. Oh. So, you know, if you shoot 500 fish, obviously $250. So, and the lake associations feel that that's worth it to them. So we feel that we should be able to kind of spread this out over the state, because right now we're kind of we're jammed into some certain lakes. You know, we have the bulk of our members are in the St. Cloud area, like a 50-mile radius around St. Cloud, and there isn't that many lakes there. So when you get too many boats on there, that's the way you get complaints.
Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me about the Asian carp? How are you doing those at night as well? I know I see them jump out of the water after the boat's going by. Is that the only time they ever come out of the water?
Mr. Morrison?
The silver carp, there's several species. We'll break them down into the three that we're most worried about right now is the silver carp, the big head carp, and the grass carp. The silver carp are what you would call the flying carp. And they're making their way up the Mississippi River system from Arkansas, mm-hmm. basically. And they do, if they're disturbed by a prop wash or even a trolling motor wash, they'll jump out of the water. The big head carp, they're a plankton feeding fish. And the problem with that is that they grow extremely rapidly compared to any domestic fish, and they can push out, they can totally interrupt a food chain and push out other native species like, say, paddlefish, for instance, who are also plankton feeders. But the problem with these fish is once they get past these barriers, make it up these rivers, into these streams, into lakes, it's very hard to get them out of there without damaging other good species in our game fish. And the most viable way to monitor them and remove them is with bow fishing. And they are, big head carp, for instance, feed right on the surface at night. And you have to be a little quieter with them, but you can take large numbers of those out at night because they're in sometimes schools, like in the south, for instance, in Kentucky, it's not unusual to come to a school of big head carp that is literally a mile long and almost the width of the river. So, and obviously if in our bow fishing, if we were doing this at night, especially on the Mississippi River, we'd be able to monitor those fish. We would know what's going on. For instance, in Nebraska, South Dakota, the Yankton on the border there on the Missouri River, 10 years ago we would bow fish there and we might see one or two of these big head carp. Now we see thousands when we go. But they and we're the only ones that can really take them out of there because they don't bite on hook and line.
Other questions for Mr. Morrison? Otherwise, we'll move to our other witness.
Actually,
Mr. Morrison?
If I may interrupt you, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to say when I was talking about the concerns, Senator Ingebretson said something about, kind of joking about the walleye thing.
Sure.
But in my experience, and I not only bow fish in Minnesota, but I do in a lot of states from here all the way to the Gulf Coast, and we don't see too many walleyes actually when we're bow fishing because the type of cover we're in is not your typical walleye feeding habitat. And as Brian said, they're very easily identifiable, so it's really not a concern. If an individual is going to poach a critter, he's going to do it regardless if we have a law that we can bow fish at night or not.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Hi, my name is Pat Kirschbaum. I'm the vice president of Land O'Lakes Bow Fishing Association. Expanding on the identification of rough fish at night, I bring a lot of new people out bow fishing every year. A lot of them have never shot archery, and none of them have ever bow fished. And when I get them out in a boat, the easiest way to tell them is if you see a big fish, not just what you think is a big fish, but most carp that I end up harvesting probably exceed 20 pounds. And if you see a 20-pound walleye in a lake, I'm going back hook and line, but there's an easy way to identify rough fish because of their physical size, and there's, how close they are, they're easily identified. I find myself going over to Wisconsin almost exclusively to bow fish. I spend quite a bit of nights going over there, weeknights, weekends, because of the less restrictions that they have. I'm able to go on any body of water. Their seasons open earlier. For the sport aspect, I'm able to go over there, enjoy my sport, longer and, you know, able to harvest more rough fish over there, and they've got some great bodies of water. Anybody that I do bring out bow fishing, whether it's in Minnesota or Wisconsin, I know without a doubt they are asking to go back out a second time. I have had a lot of people go out and purchase equipment wanting to go back out, you know, and they are rigging up their family cruising boats to go out bow fishing. So anybody that goes out bow fishing enjoys it, finds themselves going back a second time to enjoy the sport. With that, you know, they may not be able to harvest, you know, the numbers that, you know, some of the other guys do that have been into it many years, but even to remove one carp out of a body of water is essentially going to help the body of water out. It helps to remove many, but bringing the sport into Minnesota, acting responsibly, I fully agree with the way the law is drafted currently, that we need to protect the homeowners. The lakes that I go to, the rivers that I go to, I do not go towards the homes. I stay away from them. If that is the prime habitat for carp, I still will not go near homes, knowing that the noise and the lights will disrupt residents of the lake. And just being responsible, I'm not into disturbing homeowners. I have been on lakes in Minnesota this past year, enjoying nighttime bow fishing. What I did notice on a Thursday night on Clearwater Lake, I saw probably 12 to 13 boats out on a weeknight bow fishing. And that brings it back to, out of the 73 lakes that was in this rule change, I would say probably 15 to 20 of them were quality lakes that kept clean water throughout the 90-day season that people were able to go to. So out of the 73, we were down to about 20 that were quality lakes to go out and bow fish on. To open up the entire state, you're going to take the people that crowded that one lake, and you're going to disperse them out to the other bodies of water, so the residents of that one particular lake were not going to be affected. Our group's been proactive talking to lake associations and stuff. We've had lake associations ask the DNR to have their lakes added to the nighttime list, so we would be able to go in there and harvest rough fish out of their lake, and they were turned down, saying that that was not an option. So what this would do is allow the lake associations to work with our group or other bow fishermen to get them to come to their lakes and to help remove the rough fish population that they have. So is there any questions for me?
Questions for Mr. Kirschbaum. Is this Mr. Williams?
Yes, sir.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Mr. Chairman and the committee members. My name is Ryan Williams, for the record, and I am currently a resident of Hudson, Wisconsin, and spent the majority of my life in Minnesota as a resident, and many of those years were spent bow fishing. My wife and I are very avid bow fishermen, and we spend a lot of time on the water throughout the season. What we're talking about here is not a novel idea. This is not something that is fresh to our state at this point in time. It's been something that's 95% of our states enjoy in the whole nation on a daily basis, and they can fish year-round for the most part. So what we're talking about here is not anything novel or anything new or out of the ordinary, but it's just something that, you know, like it's been talked about before, we're asking to be a part of and, quite frankly, enjoy some rights. So part of me being here today was just to have someone out of state come in and just, you know, one of the main reasons for me moving over to Wisconsin was to partake in a sport that means a lot to my family. And it, Wisconsin went through this very same process not too long ago, and everything has worked beautifully over there. So any body of water that you're able to harvest rough fish night or day, or during the daytime, excuse me, you can harvest rough fish at night. So and that includes border waters as well. And that's one of the main concerns. I live right in Hudson, close to the St. Croix. It's a shot right down in the Mississippi. Being a Wisconsin resident, I can fish all that body of water at night anytime I want, you know, within the regulatory season. And a Minnesota resident cannot. And that's part of the law right now, and that's part of what we're trying to change here, just give the residents of Minnesota that right. And as for, you know, like Pat just got done talking about, is, you know, the trial has gone very well in the last year, but it's very, very, quite frankly, overflowing right now with boats trying to get into these restricted number of lakes that are on that list to fish. So by opening up the whole state to the bodies of water that support rough fish harvesting already, is going to alleviate any of the concerns, I think, that the lake homeowners have. And we've gone through, you know, like Brian talked, you know, very, very extensive measures on decibel meetings or decibel level readings of generators to, you know, rigging up your lights to where if you're passing by a structure or a dock or a home, a lake home or another boat, you can actually shut off a bank of those lights to respect their privacy. So those are the measures that, you know, a lot of the Minnesota fishermen have taken to really, you know, take into consideration of other people on the water. And in Wisconsin, we do the same thing. And it's worked out very well. And we really work heavily with the Lake Association. And with those people, and I think Mark Morrison mentioned it, they actually provide a bounty on taking rough fish out of their waters. Because it promotes other species to thrive. And getting rid of any invasive species that you can is a good thing to our water. And so working with the Lake Association, other fishing clubs, the bass fishing clubs, all that is, you know, has promoted the riddance of the invasive species. So it's worked out very well in Wisconsin.
Mr. Williams, tell me a little bit about these banks of lights.
Sure.
I mean, is it a big floodlights? I mean,
yeah, what a lot of guys do, Mr. Chairman, is they use a couple different types of lights. Either a halogen light is probably the most common, a metal halide light, or a high-pressure sodium light like your street lights, anything to illuminate the water. And you can set up your boat in a variety of different ways. But what a lot of guys will do is use a breaker system to protect the boat from any type of fire or whatever. You have to have a ground fault interruption there. So you use a breaker system, and you can put those lights on different banks. So if you're running two sides of your boat, you know, you can definitely switch off a side if you'd like to or not. So that's, you know, one option that I think a lot of us fishermen do use.
Other questions for Mr. Williams?
Sure.
Mr. Williams, you need a non-resident license then when you come down the St. Croix?
Yes, sir, I do. Not on the St. Croix.
Or
any other body of water in Minnesota, I do.
Okay.
I need a non-resident fishing license, absolutely. On the St. Croix, I do not.
And it's an angling license or a spearing?
Just an angling license, yes.
Okay.
And with the Wisconsin fishing license, I can partake in any activity on the river that I want to that is in the regulations. If I want to fish with three lines, which is supported by the state of Wisconsin, I can do that. But a Minnesota resident right now, as the state legislature or as the statute is written, cannot. So you're governed by the more liberal of the two states that you live in. So,
other questions? Is it Mr. Ziegler?
Mr. Ellenberg.
Might be a new addition.
All right. Well, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
We do need your name for the record.
My name for the record is Mark Ellenberg. I'm from White Bear Lake, Minnesota. I'm one of the co-founders of the Land O'Lakes Bow Fishing Association, and I was the past president and vice president for the Bow Fishing Association of America and the current state rep for that organization, the only national bow fishing organization in the United States. I'm here today to help you decide this is a good bill for us and people in Minnesota. Basically, it comes down to we've tried a path that is not working based on the limited scope and availability for people out there to enjoy bow fishing. You know, whether you live in Bemidji or up the Lake of the Woods or Rochester or Worthington, right now, depending on where you live, kind of dictates where you go or not go because it's too far or you don't have access. And it's about access. opening this up will alleviate most of the problems that people do have when they see us out there. Most people don't know what we're doing. And like I said, once they figure out what we're doing, I'd say 90% of the people are get right in there and say, go get them. Okay. The other 10%, some, you know, just don't want you there. Some don't like you hunting fish. That you get that with all groups. So opportunity is a big deal for us. And bow fishermen in general are seclusive. How many times have you been out fishing and seen a bow fisherman? Pretty rare. You know, there's quite a few of us out there, but you have hardly ever noticed we're there. So people say, well, they're gonna be bow fishermen popping up all over, and no, that's not. You know, there's a huge number of bow fishermen in the Twin Cities, but given the current statutes, you cannot bow fish in the metro lakes because of the firearm ordinance. In the bill, I would like to point out, we're not seeking to open up any of the metro lakes, you know, downtown Minneapolis, downtown St. Paul. What we've asked for is river access, basically Minnesota, Mississippi, and the St. Croix. No houses, no people, very few campgrounds, access for the people right here in town. That alleviates everybody going north on the weekends and crowding lakes.
Senator Sieben.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was wondering why the St. Croix River wasn't included. It's not included currently in the language we have.
Okay.
Subdivision 4 is, it mentions Mississippi and Minnesota. Yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sieben, we are, however, addressing the St. Croix River issue in a separate provision, which was passed by this committee. It's now in the Environment Policy Bill. It authorizes the DNR to do rulemaking to allow that.
Why is that different than the Mississippi and Minnesota rivers because of the wild and scenic?
Part of it, yes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sieben, it might have something to do with the border water issue.
But the Mississippi is border issue, too.
I think the bill says, Mr. Knopf can enlighten me. Does the bill say Mississippi in the metro?
Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chairman, the bill said the bill is the entire stretch of the Mississippi River and the entire stretch of the Minnesota River, the way your bill is worded. I don't think in 1110, though, that would take care of these discharge ordinances in the St. Croix. I think you would need to include it in this bill if you wanted to ensure that that you could bull fish in areas that had a discharge ordinance on the St. Croix. You'd have to include it here.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Sieben, we could talk about that. I don't have a problem with including St. Croix. Think about whether you think it would be a good thing to do, and I'm certainly amenable to it.
Follow-up, Senator Sieben? Or?
No.
Okay. Other questions? Or Mr. Ellenberg, more testimony?
Yeah, and, you know, Minnesota is at the forefront when it comes to education and kids in the outdoors. Everybody knows that. We're no different here. The LLBA sponsors the biggest bow fishing kids event in the United States, held locally here in Lionel Lakes on the Rice Creek Chain of Lakes. We take out a bunch of kids from East St. Paul that are in the John Glenn Archery Program, and we take them out for a day of bow fishing. Now, that's limited because we're limited to the daylight hours. Now, if we do that, instead of taking out 200 kids a day, we could take out 400 or 500. You know, and, you know, everybody's into getting kids in the outdoors, getting into hunting and fishing activities. This combines both in one deal. And when you take kids bow fishing and they get a chance to see all these fish and have a good time hunting fish, it's really exciting. And they get involved, and they want to come back every year. And every year we get asked for more kids to come, and we can't do it because we have limited scope when we can do that. So there's that kind of thing that's going on in the education part of it, you know, and it just makes sense in the terms of the economy. I spend 90% of my free income bow fishing, and it's not staying here in Minnesota because I can't do it. You know, it's a limited scope. 15 minutes, I can be over in Wisconsin enjoying the rights over there, but I can't here. I go to Minnesota, I go to Wisconsin, I go to Iowa, Illinois. I'll go all the way to Florida. But the question is, for the average Joe Blow that wants to enjoy this, if he doesn't have the opportunity, he's not going to do it, so he's not going to spend the money. And in a time of when we need to be keeping money home, this will help, whether it's a lot or a little, would be a good deal. Now, people say, how much can you take out of a lake? I'll give you. Everybody know where Cedar Lake is, next to the Cedar Lake Speedway? First year that opened up,
Cedar Lake. Which Cedar Lake?
Mm-hmm. It's over in Wisconsin, right above Osceola. Okay. Cedar Lake Speedway up there, their track. First year, me and another guy took out personally 20 tons of fish. 20 tons. We're only two boats. Now, in that system, we made a big, huge dent in the population. Okay, it's a smaller lake. We can do that. Now, if you get into a great big system, open-ended system, we're not going to be making big dents in the population. So that's not ever going to happen. Because you take them out, they come back in. Okay. So as a tool, yes, we can be used as a tool to help in the invasive species. Now, you asked, can we get the silvers and bigheads and grass carp at night? Yes, we can. And they're here. I've seen them. They're down at Big Lake, just below Lake Pepin. I've seen them. I've seen them jump. They're there. I haven't harvested any yet because they just showed up 3 years ago. You know, I know they're there. We're rough fish experts. We know where they are. We know their patterns, and we know how to hunt them. So, yes, we are a tool, and it's up to you guys whether we're going to be part of that tool for that problem. And Minnesota is at the forefront when it comes to carp removal and carp prevention. And, you know, everybody's read about Swan Lake. Well, they spent a ton of money on that for the duck hunters. They didn't ask us if that wasn't available. But, you know, $150,000 to kill out a lake, you guys got better time and better use for that money somewhere else, right?
Senator Scherer?
Thank you. My questions are, I think what you're talking about is interesting, but I'm thinking about, in my part of the state, there's a number of lakes,
right.
And I know the people testifying here are from my district,
right.
So I also know that there's a lot of people that live around those lakes,
right.
And I'm trying to get a visual of what this bank of lakes looks like and how those are powered. Is there a generator?
You have a generator hooked up to a
Mr. Ellenberg
power cord, and that basically, like you turn on your floodlights at home,
you guys.
We just use the generator to turn on our lights.
And are those a bank of lights?
Senator Scherer?
Are those a bank of lights that go out across the top of the lake, or are they aimed?
Well, they
down
go around the front of the boat and boat and
Mr.
down
Ellenberg.
Both sides a little way, and then they shine. We've got them angled down into the water. Now there is some refraction. You're going to get some refraction.
Senator Sharon, what it is, they're in a boat, and there's a small generator in the boat, and then there is a light in the boat. And so then they float around the lake, and the light points down at the water
looking for
mm-hmm. the fish.
It's not out over the lake.
No, it's not like somebody taking a floodlight. You know how they do that when they're coming into the dock to check stuff. No, it's not like that.
Follow up, Senator Sharon.
Thank you. And I'm just noticing 150 feet from an occupied structure.
Right.
It strikes me that the setback from the shore that could be the setback from the shore. Is that from the occupied structure or from the shoreline?
Wherever it is. If you're on your pontoon sitting out in the middle of the lake, you got to stay away from that. If you're sitting on the dock watching the stars, you got to stay away from that.
But I'm talking.
If you're in your house,
Senator Scherer.
In the house, if you've got a setback in your house, it's 100 feet from the shoreline,
mm-hmm.
then this boat could be 50 feet from the shoreline.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm. Still quite a ways.
Yeah.
And I know some of this is very close to the shoreline. These fish are close to the shoreline.
Said, most
so
people are not going to be, when we have a. When you look at a lake, you first look it over and say, where are all the houses? Okay. Now, are they right on the water? If you are, you know and I know what's going to happen. If we run that bank and there's a bunch of houses right on the water, you know, old cabins that got the clearance to be that close to the water and they chop down all their trees and they have a nice grass lawn, you know what's going to happen. You know, most of the guys that are doing it are not looking for a confrontation. That's what's going to happen. There's going to be a confrontation there.
Here is.
Yeah. But most of the lakes down in your area, there's plenty of spots for no confrontation. And that's where most of the fish are anyways.
Senator Dill.
Mr. Chair, just to interject on Senator Sharon.
Chaudhry.
Just from one lakeshore owner, if there is a bow fisherman at night in my bay taking out carp and I can hear them for a little while or whatever, or I can see their lights, I'm going to roll over and put the pillow over my ear because they're doing me a favor by removing the rough fish. But even then, we have decibel requirements on the type of generator. It has to be the quiet generator type. It cannot be loud. If you know the Honda four strokes, the small ones, those are what we are limiting the generator use to. Those are whisper quiet.
Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhary, or maybe one of the witnesses, what was the thinking on the 150-foot and the 300-foot setback from the occupied structure in the campsite?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dill, the thinking was to address the sound issue of the generator, even though we are requiring whisper quiet generators in the boats to do this at night. The Bow Fishing Association suggested an additional setback just to provide comfort language to homeowners that that there is some sort of distance requirement and that people would not be disturbed.
Senator Dibble. Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Dibble, I had promised Senator Phoebe next. So we're going to go Phoebe, Dibble, Sharon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I live on a lake. I'm a homeowner on a lake, and I thank you for your testimony. And when you see this, we have had bow fishing on our lake, and I would love you to come to my lake this spring because we need a lot more. These species, these invasive fish, are really not good for lakes, and you would harvest a lot out of my little lake. But it's fascinating to watch. I would not roll over and put the pillow over my head. I'd go out on my patio. It is fascinating to watch. And I can understand where you say when you bring people out, they always want to go out again. I can understand that, and I think this would be a great thing for local lakes. This is a huge issue. And as a homeowner living on a lake who's had bow fishing on my lake, it doesn't bother the homeowners.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure what's not to love. I'm very excited about this, too. A few years ago, like the comments, it's not in my district, but I think the park board of the city or the watershed district, someone paid a lot of money to do a big netting operation to get as much of the rough fish as they could out of Lake Nokomis. And I think they're actually going to have to go back and do it again here in not too long. So this is great. And actually, I recall as a kid watching the bow fisher trying to hit the carp that were trying to jump up a waterfall.
Yeah.
That was fun to watch. They actually got a few, too. It takes a pretty fast. I am curious about the in the river, Senator Chaudhary, Mississippi and Minnesota, particularly in the urban area. We don't anticipate any problems with discharging the bow. You know, I'm thinking about near Nicollet Island or someplace where there's a little more activity.
Well,
you know, I'm sure in the gorge it'd be fine because, you know, that's pretty remote. But up where in the upper river where there's more activity and more people.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, we still have the distance requirement.
Mm-hmm.
And then also bows, even if it was shot straight or up, their distance is very limited.
Okay.
And then in this case, they're also on a string. What's the average length of all those?
Mr. Ellenberg?
Maybe from me to you is about the farthest we shoot.
25, 30 foot?
During the day. At night, most of your shots are right in front of the boat, 3 feet out in front.
How long is your tether?
My tether for a night rig is maybe 10 yards.
So there's, Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, there's no chance of a stray arrow even if it was some, you know, when you're pointing at the water and there's a distance requirement, even if all those things, somehow the law of physics was violated and there's a stray arrow, it would still be on an average 10-yard tether.
Senator Sharon, did you have a question?
I have a couple of questions.
Go ahead.
I'm back at this 150 feet of an occupied structure. Why wouldn't it be 300 feet for both?
That's Mr. Ellenberg?
Personal experience from my travels around campsites, campers, especially the ones on the Mississippi and the St. Croix, like to drink a lot. And when they see the lights, they react in two ways. It's either favorable or very unfavorable. And I've been in a couple unfavorable confrontations with them. Usually I just keep going and turn, and sometimes they hop in their boats, they get their lights out, it's not worth it. And it's usually the campers that have the problem. They're in their tents. They're having, you know, somebody gets too close. Guess what? You're seeing what's going on in the tent. Okay? It'll light it up. If people don't respect the 150 feet on the lakeshore homes or the 300 feet on the campsites, and you don't need to be around a campsite. With this bill, there's enough water for everybody to do their thing and not have any confrontation at all. There's no need for confrontation.
Follow
you don't
up?
Need to get close to that.
I would like to see how to make this work, but I'm hearing from those who really want to have it because it's an important
right.
And because it would do good things for our lakes. I don't know if there's more testimony here, but, you know, I'm just becoming familiar here, and I know I represent in a district a lot of people who live around lakes,
yeah,
and I'm not sure what they might say about this. So that's why I'm trying to get a sense of what another perspective might be about this.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Schaudery.
Senator Schaudery.
You know, chew on it for a few days and mull it over and see what you think about it. You'll at least have the weekend. Maybe you could check around some of your constituents. Give it some thought, and if you've got some other ideas, let's talk about it.
We've got a couple others, I think, that would like to testify, so let's thank you, Mr. Ellenberg.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Go ahead.
While they're approaching, Mr. Chair,
welcome.
I just wanted to, on the science of this approach, just wanted to reference the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Draft Management and Control Plan for Asian carps in the United States, and this plan also calls for increased recreational harvest of this carp. Mm-hmm. Part of the plan.
Thank you, Senator Schaudery. Let's move to the patient witness on my left here. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and committee, my name is Tony Zenz. I'm from Malacca, Minnesota. Just wanted to have your guys' support, just testifying short here. The bow fishing of rough fish by bow and arrow, it's the fastest growing fishing sport in Minnesota right now. We never used to sell a bit of equipment for bow fishing. In the last 10 years, it's huge for us, more boats on the water, more repair for our marine shop, very good for our economy where we're at. Getting back to Senator Sharon's question about the lake associations and stuff. When night fishing had the first trial last year, we contacted several lake associations in our area, let them know what we're going to be doing out there, very in favor of it. Close by our home, by St. Cloud, Little Rock Lake was one of the lakes on this. They have so many carp in their lake. They have warnings in the winter. They wear the ice thin enough that people can fall through the lakes because of the schools of carp in there. Other than that, it's good for my economy, and thank you for your support.
Questions for Mr. Zenz? Thanks for your testimony.
Yep. I was thinking, Mr. Chair, maybe in the future, all the Lake Nokomis folks would have to do is apply for a permit from the DNR to have a bow fishing tournament there.
On this end of the table, Senator Schaudery, we were wondering if any of these guys were married because they go out all night and fish, and I can't imagine that they're married for very long.
But, used to be.
to my right, is it Soderberg?
Yes, sir.
Welcome
Mr.
to the
Chair,
committee.
As a married angler, I can tell you that that's probably why this sport has grown. Because nighttime after everyone's gone to sleep is the only time we have. Or are allowed.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, committee, my name is Eric Soderberg. I am a member of the Land of Lakes Bowfishing Association. I come to you today to show support for our group. And I would like to...
Thank you.
I could go on and on about all the great aspects of bow fishing. I thought I'd bring a little bit of somewhat scientific proof. This is straight from the DNR's website, and I quote, "Common carp are one of the most invasive, damaging aquatic invasive species due to its wide distribution and severe impacts in shallow lakes and wetlands. Their feeding disrupts shallowly rooted plants, muddying the water. They release phosphorus that increases algae abundance, and carp-induced declines in water quality causes declines of aquatic plants needed by waterfowl and fish." That's straight off the DNR website as of last night. at 7:37 p.m.
Everything good.
In Discover Magazine's top 100 science issues for 2008, number 35 is a. It was about a study done in a lake in northern Ontario, and the. It's about. I'm nervous and I'm really screwing up here, but it was about the turbidity of the water and the amount of phosphorus in relation to the algae blooms, which is what causes our lakes to turn green so early in the years here. And what this study showed was that it didn't matter how much nitrogen was put into the lake or how little nitrogen was in the lake, because of the amount of phosphorus was the key to the cyanobacteria, which are nitrogen-fixing bacteria, which is the blue-green algae.
Thank you very much.
And thus turns the lake green, causing eutrophication and killing the lakes. So there's a little bit of scientific data for that. I can't tell you how much good it does a lake to take the carp out of it. Carp have the capacity to lay about 2 million eggs in a large species, in a large specimen. That's when you get a 30-pound carp, you're talking about over a gallon bucket full of eggs. So like an ice cream pail full of eggs, which hatch within about a week and begin to take over the lake. Now you multiply that by however many thousands of fish those size are in a lake, a large body of water contains larger fish, and you can quickly see that they take over quite rapidly, and thus their invasive species status.
Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that note, to that point of science, how big does, you're talking a 20-pound carp, how long does it take to get to 20 pounds?
Mr. Soderberg.
That I don't know. It kind of varies depending on the water, on the lake size. I have an article here from the Star Tribune, which stated that some of the fish are 2 to 4 feet long, and up to 50 years old. So if that gives you any indication, it could be depending on the lake. It could be from 10 to 50 years old. So.
Other questions? Mr. Soderberg, had you completed your testimony, sir?
Yeah, take some big ones.
Yes, I did.
Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Let's move to my left again. Is this Mr. Krogstad?
Yes.
Welcome to the committee.
Chair, committee members, thank you. My name is Darren Krogstad. I think we've pretty much covered everything here, I guess. I guess I'm the last one, but I'll speak just from my personal situation. I live in Hastings. And as far as night fishing goes, in order to get to a lake to night fish on myself, there's a lake in Cannon Falls that's open. Otherwise, I'm looking at basically an hour-long trip just to get to some lake that I can fish in Minnesota at night. By taking away the river as an option, which is what I do probably 90% of my fishing on, I'm stuck. Basically, as far as convenience-wise anyway, sure, I can go that far and whatnot, but you add in a 2 hours worth of commuting to get to the lake and whatever, too, that makes for a short night of fishing. So, and as far as the border waters go, as we've covered, both Wisconsin, Iowa, and South Dakota all have night fishing available. And as it was covered before, to have Wisconsin residents able to fish on the Mississippi and Minnesota residents not able to fish on the Mississippi, I guess personally it makes no sense to me myself. So the other point I was going to cover was that as far as kids getting active in the outdoors, all the articles you read about kids in the outdoors, everyone's worried about kids not being involved in the outdoors anymore, and the numbers are going down and this and that. A sport like bow fishing, you take kids out they can't stop talking about it. They, oh, that was so cool. That was the, you know, tell their friends all about it and whatever, and they can't wait to go out again. So you provide them with night fishing, which is, you know, typically a lot more active. You know, you see a lot more fish, you see bigger fish, you know, it's just, it's a whole nother experience. It's just another avenue to get kids involved in the outdoors. So I believe it's a very important tool for this state to have.
Mr. Krogstad, other than bringing your children along, do bow fishermen typically fish alone?
Typically, I mean, it depends on the situation. You can do it by yourself or, you know, I mean, typically you like to have another person along just to pass the time with, you know, of course. But it's something that can be done alone. It's something that can be done with, you know, four or five people in your boat, depending on how big your boat is or whatever. There's really no restrictions or limits on what you're capable of having. So
is your equipment as heavy as what a deer hunter would use?
As far as poundage on the bow, typically you use lower poundage just because a lot of your shooting is going to be within, you know, the top maybe 3 feet of water. So you don't want the full weight, because especially myself shooting in the rivers, you're shooting in shallower water. You have higher poundage. You have a lot more shooting into the muck and the weeds and whatever, so it's harder to get it out. So you have lower poundage bows, or you turn your bows down or whatever, so you don't have as much of the weight.
But we're assuming you hit the fish.
Well,
we all sounds like that. We got a misser.
What kind of tip do you have on that arrow?
They actually, different companies make different kinds of tips, but what I use is a tip made by Muzzy. It has a what they call a trocar tip on it. It's just a super sharp tip that will turn. It's a tip, and then it has two prongs coming down from it. And if you hit a fish, you simply turn the tip a couple of turns, and then those prongs flip up, and you pull the arrow out of the fish. There are many, many, many different kinds of tips depending on what you prefer and where you buy your stuff, I guess. So.
And if you're in an off a tributary or a slow water, shallow water, do you ever chum or use bait?
No.
Do you bait them at all?
No, that isn't legal.
Okay.
So,
Senator Ingebretson.
Mr. Chair, and I, not from Cannon Falls, but I know Lake Bilsby needs it, right?
Yeah.
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 Okay. Just a comment.
Okay, and Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Krog said, so tell me real briefly how it's different fishing for bow fishing in a river where there's a lot of current. Or I mean, because if you're from Hastings, a lot of the river around there is pretty fast flowing.
Right.
Mr. Krog said.
Typically, you're fishing in the backwaters off the river. So, I mean, it's included in the river system, but it's not directly in the channel. So you're in, you know, back ponds and upstream on, you know, off channels and stuff like that. And that's the thing with the night fishing as far as including the river. I mean, typically where I fish, there aren't any houses. So I'm not going to be bugging anybody with my lights or my generator. So putting us on these lakes that have all these houses on them, I mean, you have nothing but options for trouble, basically, when you get all these people on these types of water. So you open it up to the, I mean, like has been said, people don't want to bug homeowners. We don't want to be right up next to somebody's house. We want to be on water we're familiar with, or water where we won't have any problems.
And Mr. Krog said you're not going to fish typically in current. I mean, fast
no.
current.
No, that's not where the fish are going to be.
Right.
So that isn't, I mean, there's no point in even being there.
Senator Dill, did you have a question?
Well, I just was wondering here, we've got these fish that can reproduce like crazy. I don't know, what did I mention, a million eggs per female, or what was it? Or,
I think I heard
anyway.
2 million.
2 million, whatever it is. There's something that can reproduce like crazy. And so I'm just wondering how much good it really does to take out a few hundred pounds or a few thousand fish out of a lake or a river with all that reproduction going on.
Well, what you have to look at is that what are we taking out now compared to what could we take out if we had night fishing open to the whole state? I mean, like was mentioned by Mr. Ellenberg in Wisconsin, the amount of fish he was able to take out in a night or in a season by night fishing is just remarkable. And that's just two boats.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Dill, as
Senator Chaudhry.
Earlier testimony indicated, it depends. If it's in a water system that has a lot of inlets and outlets, where there's lots of free flow of rough fish from great distances, it may not make a huge difference. But in a more enclosed system, absolutely, it could make a huge difference. So, yeah, it can make a difference some places and others. We are not proposing this as the silver bullet to silver carp, but we are saying that this is an important tool. In fact, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has recommended this as a tool.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, I think it's great. There's a lot of enthusiasm for this. I'm glad there's people out there harvesting these carp and other rough fish, and I thank you for doing that. I'm glad you can find some enjoyment in it and be willing to do it night after night after night and so on. But I'm still kind of wondering. There's just so much capacity out there to carry fish in a particular water body, and you diminish the population to some extent. And then you got these females dropping 2 million eggs a year or whatever it is. It seems like it's kind of a losing battle.
Well, all we're trying to accomplish is to do what we can to help. And like it's been stated, we're basically doing it for free. And matter of fact, we're paying you guys or paying the state. So we're providing a service ultimately. And what we can accomplish is all that we can accomplish, but this is helping our cause.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dill, we're not hiring Chaudhry. Them to do this. We're just letting them go out and have fun and do us a favor at the same time.
Senator Ingebretson?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, you're not suggesting a 16-shot clip, I hope.
Would be more effective?
That's a personal goal.
Inside
I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, don't.
Senator Dill.
The sheriff got Senator Dibble and myself mixed up again.
He does. Senator Dill, he does that occasionally, yeah, and we forgive him.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Chaudhry.
If they want to comment, I don't know if they do or not.
Anyone else here that is would like to speak in favor of this legislation, first of all?
I think we covered it.
Okay. Anyone against opposing this legislation? Would the DNR like to weigh in? Hey. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, Ron Pyer with DNR Fisheries. And I think this does offer some expanded opportunities, and we support that. And we've worked with this group fairly closely with Brian and others as we've gone through rulemaking, and we have promulgated some rules. And they're a pretty responsible group. The type of standards that they set are admirable, and if everybody would follow those, I think that's a very positive effect. They're good mentors. When we worked with them initially, we decided to pilot this program because we've allowed daytime bow fishing for many years and have not for many years allowed nighttime bow fishing. So the approach was to select some waters, go in and try them, see if we did incur some problems. And so we based that on existing rough fish populations. There was already some rough fish harvest. Development, lower development was desirable. That they weren't close to spearing, and so we identified the 73 waters, and we've been through one season. And I would say it's fair that this is any controversy is more of a social than a biological issue. It is the lights, it is the noise. We're not concerned as much about game fish impacts of illegal harvest. I think it also is fair to say, though, and Senator Chaudhry referenced, that it's not a silver bullet to invasive species control. I think in most situations it's not going to have very much of an impact. I was really impressed, though, with 40,000 pounds out of one lake. I mean, that's really striking. And so I think on some systems it certainly would have an effect for a given year. But they are prolific. We've spent a lot of time with carp traps, carp seining, commercial operators, and the carp is a tough critter, and we really haven't mastered that. It's kind of irrelevant to this bill. It's they do take fish. It can help. It's certainly not going to hurt. It's a use of the protein. The difference in this bill right now is that it does change the season. Right now on our pilots, we only allow night bow fishing on these waters for June, July, and August. So this would open up year-round, and it also does open all statewide waters. Just want to point out there's already exceptions that are in place for things like designated trout lakes and streams, designated spawning areas, scientific and natural areas. There's a suite of areas where you can't spear or do that.
Mr. Pyre, how do we know that? Is it posted at the lake, or is it in the regulations on the website? How can these bow fishermen find that?
Mr. Chairman, it is in a rule, and it's accessible by the website. I think most of the folks, at least the folks that we're dealing with on a regular basis, are pretty knowledgeable about the rules and regulations. There's always, as we know, getting information out to everybody is a real challenge, and so there's certainly going to be some folks that might not know. But
Did your COs check these guys once in a while?
Mr. Chairman, they did, and Chief Conrad would offer to provide some of the reports he heard from his conservation officers over the course of the summer. Couple points that I would like to make is that, as Senator Chaudhry referenced, we are pursuing through Senate File 1110, the Emergency Rule Authority, to open or close. We are pursuing and will pursue the Wisconsin-Minnesota border waters. Irregardless of the outcome of this, we intend to open that. When we first started the process, Wisconsin hadn't made that change yet. They have now. There's absolutely no reason to restrict Minnesota anglers from going on those systems. And then it might be that we'd need a good cause exemption for the existing rules. We do have those 73 waters listed by rule right now, so we'll want to, if this law passes, we'll want to be able to go in and change, modify that rule. And the two approaches you have to this are the pilot, as we started, and you ease into it, and then you add waters. And the downside of that is, while you do identify issues, eventually you get a pretty long list of lakes that you can apply a night bow fishing. The other one is to go more statewide, and in that case, you determine where the problems are, and you back out the water. So we've started with the pilot. This would kind of go towards the second mechanism. So I thank you, Chief Conrad. I'd be welcome for any other questions, but Chief Conrad has some information on what we did find out from our officers over the first season.
Mr. Pyre, I'll just have you sit tight in case there is a follow-up question. Welcome back to the committee, Chief.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, the violations and problems that we encountered were very few, considering the number of body of waters that we had where this was allowed. Mostly, once again, as Chief Pyre pointed out, it was mostly social issues surrounding the use of the lights and the increased activity at late night on those bodies of water. There was also a lack of knowledge of the lakeshore owners as to the legality of that fishing activity, and perhaps with a statewide authorization of that activity, that a public relations campaign might be fruitful in alleviating some of those complaints.
Typically during the pilot, were your officers called out, or were they out checking?
In most cases, they received complaints or calls while they were at home, some of them very late at night, and responded in providing the information that it was a legal activity, and at that point the callers generally said, oh, okay, and that was the end of it. And as far as illegally taking game fish, that was, as far as I know, there were no violations encountered there.
Senator Kielash.
Mr. Chair, I just wondering, was there any concern or was there any reports of dead fish left on by the lakes or on the rivers that has that been a problem, or is it something that we need to be concerned about?
Chief Conrad?
Mr. Chair, Senator, not related to the bow fishing, the night bow fishing. We do have that issue with daytime bow fishing and also recreational spearing, where there are some indications that there were piles of dead carp left at public accesses and that sort of thing. But I don't believe that they were related to these the number of lakes that we opened up for that for this activity.
Senator Chaudhry.
Mr. Chair, maybe a question for Mr. Pyre, Mr. Conrad. In these experimental lakes or pilot lakes, was there a setback requirement?
Mr. Pyre?
Or
distance requirement?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry, no, there was not. Our rule at this point in time does not have any setbacks.
So, Mr. Chair, few complaints.
Senator Chaudhry.
Few complaints, even in a concentrated situation, and there wasn't even a distance requirement. And in my bill, we are adding a distance requirement.
I guess it would be similar to deer hunting if the guy in the next stand is yelling at you to get out of there. Pretty soon, nobody sees any deer, so if the guy on the shore is yelling at you, you're going to move somewhere else. Believe me, I know. Senator Ingebrigtsen yells at me every once in a while when I'm deer hunting.
And Mr. Chair, as we heard, there's plenty of carp to be had in this state.
Other questions for the witnesses? Otherwise, I think we'll move on. Senator Chaudhry is very interesting. I think one theme that comes through, though, is public relations. We need to let lakes know that this is happening and citizens know, and we have a lot of people on the lakes in the summer that aren't from here. They come from Illinois and Indiana and Michigan, and so we just need to get the word out that if we go forward with this, it's happening.
It's fine, Mr. Chair. Just a couple points. First of all, as we heard, all those other states you mentioned have this. So those are people who are probably more familiar than anyone. Secondly, when you spread these 10,000 people out, and let's just say because we make it statewide, the population doubles, of bow fishermen doubles, you know, you're suddenly spreading them out so wide and thin that, you know, I think these types of just kind of educated calls to COs are would also, you know, serve just fine. And I think that's appropriate role for COs, too. They are. We want them to be educators, not just of the anglers and the hunters, but of the public.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, I need you to pay attention now because we're going to go from Dibble to Dill here. Senator Dibble.
Well, we've been confused before.
Yes, I
can tell the story again how I ended up being accused of chief authoring one of his bills.
Which was highly unlikely.
I still have, you know, on the one hand, I have a slight concern about, you know, the urban, you know, the urban core, you know, the river provision. On the other hand, I'd like to get folks onto these urban lakes. So, you know, do we have any reaction to the, you know, the provision for the for the rivers, as is spelled out in the bill, and you know, if we could figure out how to, you know, how to accommodate, you know, if there are any issues with, you know, proximity to lots and lots of activity and that sort of thing,
Senator Chaudhry,
and then get them,
Mr. Chair,
get them onto maybe some of these urban lakes.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, remember, these people can do this already during the day, and that's when the primary activity is, and all we're saying is that we'd like them to do it at night where there's hardly any actual activity on the water, and especially on the Mississippi in the urban core, the houses are so far back or up off that I don't see how it would be a disturbance at all, but maybe you see a different view.
Follow up.
Well, there is a distinction from the gorge in the upper river. I mean, when you're in the upper river, you're pretty close to structures and activity and people recreating, all kinds of stuff going on, you know, downtown and north of downtown. As you move a little further south, then you're getting down into the gorge, and it's, you know, it's virtually separated from the rest of the city.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, at night?
So there's still a lot of stuff, and there's houses, and you know, and there's a lot of stuff going on still.
Pets and things.
You know, okay,
folks are jogging. You know, it's the city. You know, it's a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah. Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, if somebody at the table could maybe let me know if this is legal. I've got 2.25 miles of the North Fork of the Crow River going through my farm. And at one end of the farm, there's a popular place where people walk in about 100 yards to fish. And when they catch rough fish, carp, and so forth, they throw them out into one of my fields, tillable fields, corn fields, hay fields, soybean field, whatever happens to be growing there at the time. Is that okay?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'll address that.
Colonel?
If you allow it, it's okay. If you don't like it, then it would be a violation. If it's something that you don't want them to do, then it would be a violation.
Would a sign take care of that, or does he need to go down and talk to people?
Well, I think a few fish around each corn plant might be good for you.
Senator Frederickson, I think we'll move along. Did you?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry, I had a couple amendments that I'd like to present. And the first one is just for clarification. A careful reading of the law would not be necessary. But on page 2, line 12, after season, I would move to insert for residents and non-residents. A careful technical reading of the law, and it would not be necessary, but if you'd look at 97C.375, the taking of rough fish, there it specifies both resident and non-resident, and I think we should parallel that in this section.
Okay. Anything else, Senator?
Another amendment later.
Okay, let's take this one. Members, we're on page 2, line 12. Senator Frederickson moves that after the word season, insert for residents and non-residents. Questions on that amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Frederickson.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry, and had I spotted this before the next one before committee, I would have talked with you about it. But on page 1, line 17, I'd move to delete any and insert A. Delete cannot. And insert must not. Delete everything after contain, and on line 18, delete introduce. So I would read, a battery that is used in lighted fishing lures must not contain mercury.
You were striking the first any then in that
That's right.
line.
Right.
Okay.
Grammatical.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry, I don't know what any intentionally induced. I don't know what that means. Yeah.
How do you
I think
it?
Now we should say we mean it. Don't put mercury in our waters.
Yeah. Grammatical correction on line 17. Questions? Senator Chaudhry, are we okay with that? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Frederickson. Always watching those sentences. I appreciate that. Senator Chaudhry?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Pyer suggested another amendment in the rules. They have in there that somewhere that it says, where it says, a person must take reasonable measures to retrieve arrows and wounded fish. That's reasonable to insert somewhere in the bill. Mr. Knopf, can you find a
logical place for us to include the recovery of the arrows?
Mr. Chairman, probably in subdivision 2 with the possession of bows and arrows, just insert after the period a person must make, was it a reasonable attempt?
Yes.
A person must take reasonable measures to retrieve arrows and wounded fish. That's from the rules.
Members, to that amendment.
I'll move that.
Senator Chaudhry moves a reasonable attempt to retrieve arrows and wounded fish. Questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Chaudhry, do we want to lay this on the table?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Frederickson.
I would like to just comment a little bit about some research that's been going on with carp, and Senator Chaudhry knows this too, from the Environmental Trust Fund and through LCMR and now LCCMR. For the past few years, we've been funding research on carp. The earlier projects involved pheromones and also researchers in Australia, and more recently additional research, I believe it's by Dr. Sorensen, on the habits of carp. And in fact, one of the surprising things the researchers have found is that these big carp don't necessarily spawn or reproduce every year. And they're finding out some new and interesting features about carp. So if we keep funding the research, maybe sooner or later we'll figure out a way to better control them. And I want to mention that because sometimes what we do with the Environmental Trust Fund sort of gets lost. People don't track what's going on, and I think we should at least mention it once in a while.
Senator Chaudhry?
Maybe we could start funding purses for bow fishing tournaments. prizes meaning.
And with that, we'll lay Senate file. Senate file 1798, as amended, has been laid on the table for possible inclusion. I want to thank the bow hunters, who the bow fishermen who came this afternoon and stuck around and stayed for this evening. We appreciated your testimony and your patience. Thanks so much. Senator Chaudhry, let's move to Senate file 1968.
I can look up the rule, too.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill emerges out of a couple of discussions we've had over the past couple of years and legislation we've had establishing a fee structure for fishing tournaments. Didn't pass without much controversy here. Had some impacts out in the field. It's been a source of consternation in the fishing community. There have been a couple of DNR roundtable conference discussions centered around this. And this past DNR roundtable in January, we had to talk about how we could modify the fee structure. We understand that there is a need to fund the permitting process for tournaments, but it appears from the angling community that perhaps the fees are excessive and are leading towards negative consequences. So we're proposing to do a number of things in this bill. Number one, we are proposing to reduce the fees by half in each category of the size of tournament. But we're also proposing to close a loophole that the angling community feels has been abused, and that's the nonprofit exception to the permit fees. That has ended up being used by for-profit entities, large tournaments that don't necessarily give to a charity. Remember, a nonprofit doesn't mean it's a charity. So by closing that loophole, I think we can also make up some of the fees that were lost by reducing our fees. We're also changing the threshold at which the fee structure is established. We're changing it from boats to individuals.
Right. From 30 individuals.
From boats to individuals. And then changing it from individuals to boats. From individuals to number of boats, excuse me. And then there is a numerical, a dollar amount exception, and then the total prize value is $500 or more. And then there's something very interesting we're doing in addition. For the first time, the bill proposes to start establishing conservation practices in fishing tournaments. It's perhaps isn't the leap that I might be interested in terms of conservation practices, but the concept is new to this particular sphere, and I think by introducing and starting to develop and disseminate best practices in fishing tournaments, I think we have a good start in spreading conservation to this area of angling. So that's just a summary. I think it's needed. This proposal was worked on by angling groups, tournament angling groups, bass, northern muskie,
bow fishing.
Oh, and we are exempting the bow fishing for all the reasons stated tonight from tournament fees. And so with me to talk about the proposal is Brent Wagner from Bass Federation, Rob Carper from Northern Zinc.
Let's start with Mr. Wagner. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Vern Wagner. I'm a longtime bass tournament fisherman. I also spent a lot of time trying to support sport fishing here in Minnesota. Sport fishing is a multi-million-dollar industry here. And fishing contests, whether that's by a small resort or a city as a festival in their community, or whether it's a bass or a muskie or walleye northern contest, that's an important part of our sport fishing. And it's a area that really drives the the industries that are involved with fishing. We're the ones who buy the boats, the fishing tackle, the motors, and buy the gas for them and fill up our trucks in gas stations in the towns we go to, buy the food there, and stay in their motels. Bass tournaments and Northern's tournament, whatever type of fishing contest here in Minnesota has a significant positive economic impact on the communities that we're involved with. This impact is so great that the city of Alexandria actually courts us to bring contests to their area because we use their resources up there. So as the tournament permit system has evolved over the last 15 years, from my perspective, it was put in place for us as tournament anglers, contest participants, to self-regulate our activities before someone else came in and decided to regulate them for us. So we wanted to participate with the DNR in a process, and this took a long time. DNR put a lot of resources into this, a lot of individuals, Frank Schneider being probably one of the prime movers in this, developed this package. And this package is for the most part, works well. And we're not trying to get rid of it. We're just trying to tweak it. When the fees were added, this changed the face of fishing contests in Minnesota. Some of the larger tournaments left Minnesota and started basing their tournaments out of Wisconsin because Wisconsin had a $25 fee. Now, that wasn't the only reason they left. I wouldn't want to try to mislead you on that. It was also participation and competition, a lot of other factors, but that was an important factor. Another thing that these fees have done, they've really changed some of these smaller fishing clubs that really just want to have fun. And an example of one is up in the Hutchinson area. They get together five times a year and have a fishing contest, and they're not really sure how many people are going to show up, but it's usually sometimes it's 30 people, sometimes it's 40. So they fell into the fee system, which was $600 for them to have their small fishing things. Well, this is a group that only pays $8 a member, and they give away a canoe paddle at the end of the year. So you can imagine the phone calls I was getting, because I'm well known about in the tournament area. You imagine the phone calls and emails I was getting. Vern, what's going on, with this? So we went in and we started looking at, okay, how did these fees come about? And my impression, and I may be wrong, we're going to hear some other testimony tonight, but it looks like the DNR took a look at who was involved in fishing contest activities and how much time they put into it, and it turned out there were 51 different staff who attributed some degree of time to this process. Now, this is a one-page application, and the figure that they came up with was $108,000, somewhere around $108,000, and so then they had to figure out, well, how are we going to do this, and we came up with the fees that we've been living with for a couple of years. So enough history. So our intention in this bill is to streamline that process, to make it more efficient, and therefore have fewer staff involved, because we don't think it's really necessary to have that many staff. How we're going to streamline it is in a couple of important ways. Number one, the state of Wisconsin has software for tournament application that's web-based, they're willing to share that with Minnesota. And this would make the system more efficient. Now, Wisconsin doesn't necessarily feel like that saves them a lot of money, but then they're only charging $25 per application. So it may not be that it's saving them a lot of money. We're not asking for the human element to be taken out of this, but we're simply saying let's streamline it and find a more efficient way of processing these applications. The second thing we would like to do is to change the threshold of who needs to apply for a permit. Right now, that threshold is 30 individuals. If there's more than 30 people, you need to have a permit. And we're proposing that rather than counting the number of people, let's count the number of boats that are involved in the contest. Because in this way, it's a more realistic estimate of how many parking spaces you're taking up, how many craft there are in the water. There's a great walleye program for youth. It pairs two walleye anglers and two kids. That would count as four people. It doesn't take very long when you're putting four people on a boat to hit that threshold. Now, if this contest with the kids was only the kids fishing, it's already exempt by the statute, already exempts them if it's only the kids. But if the adults are fishing, we end up having to count everybody in that boat. So we're saying let's look at boats. We'd like to raise the threshold to less than anyone who's putting on a contest with less than 25 boats wouldn't need to apply for this permit. Is that going to cause problems? I think some of our other people are going to talk about that as they come up and testify tonight. Second thing that we want to do, so we're streamlining the process. We would like to compel the commissioner to develop a best practices certification for people who are conducting our fishing contests in Minnesota. We'd like to envision it in some web-based practice or some test you have to take, that something that says that you know what the best way is to handle these fish. And I want to tell you right now, the best way not to handle fish is to take 8 large fish, put them in a plastic bag with very little water, and hold them standing in line to get up to a scale for 5 to 10 minutes, because there's not enough oxygen in that amount of water for those fish. So, and I could take you out today and I could show you contests that are going to great lengths to really do a great job on their fish. They're using water weigh-ins, they're using larger bags, they're using 2 bags, they're doing all these things, and I can show you contests where that's not happening. So we would like to compel the DNR to adopt this type of practice. In each of our groups, the Muskie guys, the Northern guys, the Walleye guys, all of us are willing to put together those best practices, give them to the DNR, have the DNR vet them to make sure that their biologists agree with this, and then have this put into practice. There are some other tweaks that we would like to make. I'd like to let some of the other members here testify of our stakeholders group, and if there's more questions or things they haven't covered, I would like to come back and review those.
Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one real short question. Do counties charge any permits? If they do, I can't imagine they're doing that, but an additional amount
Mr.
of money.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we're required, every organized event is required to have a sheriff's permit by the sheriff of that county. Some counties do charge. Some counties also require us to have a certificate of insurability with them listed as an insured party on that. It's usually $1 million also insured that we have to have. More and more counties are beginning to charge fees because the door has been opened now. So
mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Wagner. Welcome to the committee.
Hi. I'm Rob Carper. I'm with Northerns Incorporated. Currently secretary, I was past president and tournament manager or coordinator, whatever you want to call those. I've been doing that probably for the most part of the last 10 years. So through this permitting process, I've got to witness the evolution of what's been happening. And first of all, I'd like to say Northerns Incorporated is from Brainerd, Minnesota, and we are basically a club of anglers that like to fish northern pike. And so we have some club get-togethers, which are contests where in our local area, and, you know, the group of people that gets together is the same people every tournament. You know, they sign up for a membership fee, and we basically are getting together to have fun. Our first rule in our tournament rules is that this is a fun tournament, and anybody who's not here to have fun can go fish somewhere else. So we are very serious about the fun nature of what we do. It's not a larger money-type tournament. But we do offer open to the public once a year in September to come up to our area to fish northern pike on purpose for a larger tournament that is a money-type tournament. We could have up to 150 boats in that tournament. It's usually around 75, but, you know, we're permitted for up to 150 boats. And we understand why we have to permit that tournament and pay whatever fee the DNR thinks is appropriate to, you know, recover costs for that permitting. However, with our club tournaments, we have somewhere between it's usually between 13 and 20 boats, and usually there's two people per boat. And you can see the dilemma. Currently, the statute states that 30 people is the threshold. So, you know, we're in that area. Obviously, moving to 25 boats helps us not pay $120 per permit. That's what we're currently paying right now. We have about seven tournaments a year, which I think adds up to about $840. So my interest, one of my interests in being participating in this is that these tournaments that are mostly local, and, you know, if you think outside what our club is doing, there's a lot of other clubs that have these, you know, groups of members that get together to fish for fun. They're utilizing what Minnesota has to offer, get the kids out on the water. Our club has a lot of father-son. I actually fish with my daughter. We have father-son groups. We have husband-wife groups, brother-brother groups. I mean, this is a lot of times a family event. And we think that these kind of events probably, you know, should not be included in this permitting process. But in our local tournament, or these club tournaments that we have, typically the entry fee is like $20 per boat, so there's not a whole lot of money. We kid a lot about our total prize fund that I report the DNR each tournament is $410. We kid about it if you win the tournament that you might be able to pay for the gas to get to the tournament, and it's very nominal type prizes.
How much permit fees do you pay to the DNR throughout your summer?
Okay, he asked me to explain how much we pay, and I already said for a club tournament it's $840. Okay. And also we do pay a $400 fee for the international tournament that we have in September.
So you have about $1,200, a little over $1,200 in fees.
That's right, and that comes permanent out of the fees. Members' pockets. Some way they're going to have to pay for that. So, you know, obviously our members are not happy with the permit fees. Before the permit fees came in, however, we were permitting our tournaments because we wanted to follow the law, and we're the good guys, and we want to remain that. We also, when the permit fees came in, we had, you know, although people were not happy with having to pay money that they didn't have to pay before just to fish these tournaments, we decided as a club, no, we're not going to, you know, fly under the wire and try to keep the numbers of people that can do this activity down. So we decided to pay the permits. You know, that's where we went with that. I think that's the gist of what I wanted to testify to. You know, us as a club type entity, and also we do have a public tournament, so we understand why. I think the DNR, when they first, you know, had us do permits, when we were first aware of it and we started the permitting process, wanted to manage how many tournaments were on a lake on a certain day, and we agreed with that. We thought that that was a good thing to do. But the... you know, there was no fee at that time when we were doing it. And then when the fees came in, we got to thinking about, well, how big is big enough and what is okay? You know, for what are they really trying to do here? And what we found out when we asked the question where the 30 participants came from, and that could mean 30 boats. I mean, there could be one person in each boat according to the law that's written right now. Where did that number come from? And basically what I heard from several different people who were at those meetings was it was kind of negotiated at that time with the assumption that there would be no fee anyway. Well, now there's a fee. And so that's why I thought it was important to come back and take a look at this and maybe tweak this a little bit. Another thing I'm very excited about in this, in some of the tweaks we did here, is the idea that the permitting process gets more efficient. And the idea that we move towards an electronic-type permitting process, and I think there's even something beyond that that they can go to make it more efficient. And I think that the cost that we're paying for these permits are going to cover the cost of doing that. I know everybody won't agree with me on that, but I believe that I've seen enough, getting things more efficient, that will happen eventually if we move in that direction. And this is a move in that direction.
Let's move to the witness on my right. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee. My name is Paul Perovich. I am the state youth director for the Minnesota Bass Federation and a member of the board of directors for that same federation. I'd like to talk a little bit about the economics and the impacts in Minnesota of the former rules or the current rules that we have, and how the Bass Federation, or I should say Bass in general, the national organization, perceived Minnesota and how that had affected us. And I also talked a little bit about how it affects our kids and the youth program that I run. I currently have about 300 kids in the youth program across the state. Last year, we ran over 2,500 additional children throughout the state through a program called Casting Kids, which is an introduction program. So we touched almost 3,000 kids last year with our program. Bass, which is a national organization owned by ESPN, and if anybody watches ESPN on Sunday mornings, they can see the Elite Series that they have on there. As of last February, Bass had a hands-off policy for Minnesota for any tournaments. The reason was it was too difficult to hold a tournament in Minnesota. So what did we lose? Well, all the Federation tournaments were going to be held in Minnesota that we ran. We were going to run our state tournament in Minnesota. When it was Minnesota's turn to have the Northern Divisional Championships, we were going to get it no matter what. But as far as having an open event or getting an elite event, we would never get those because it was just too difficult through the permitting process and, in their words, dealing with the DNR. Now, I disagree with some of the things that they had to say about that. When I talked to John Stewart, who was currently is the Federation's National Tournament Director, I said, what are you talking about? You can come to Minnesota anytime and have a tournament. And he said, well, if you can set up a tournament in Alexandria, Minnesota for the Northern Divisional Bass Club World Championships, you're on. I picked up the phone and I called the Chamber of Commerce in Alexandria, and I said, do you understand what the deliverables to Bass are? And she says, yeah, it's about $30,000 in cash and product. I said, yes. She says, where do you want it and when do you want it? Inside of a week, the Chamber of Commerce delivered a proposal to Bass to hold that. So if a city is willing to kick out $30,000 to hold this tournament, what's the impact coming back to them? Well, I can tell you the classic, which is the Super Bowl of bass fishing, held in Greenville, South Carolina in February of 2008, in the six-day period, brought in $22 million to Greenville. This past February, we held our classic in Shreveport, Louisiana, on the Red River. It was bigger than Greenville, and they're expecting the number to come in over $25 million. These are huge impacts. If you look at the Open Series, the Northern Open Series that they have, they would love to come to Minnesota in September. Would Walker, Minnesota like to extend their resort season by 1 week? Have 400 anglers and families come up and spend additional money in that town? The answer is yes. Same in Alexandria, your district, Senator.
Twice a year, actually, be good now.
So these are some of the economic impacts that we have to deal with. I think some of the things that we've worked with the DNR and on the roundtable committees and the Bass roundtable have answered some of these questions, and I think that this bill will put some of those things in place. We are already being looked at by the National Federation by what's going to happen on this bill. So they know all about this bill, and they know what we're trying to do up here, and they applaud it.
Senator Sieben.
I'm sorry, I forgot your last name.
Perovich.
Mr. Perovich. So this legislation, are you saying just because the fee would be less, that it would greatly increase the chances that these tournaments would come to Minnesota? Or are you talking about more generally beyond the scope of this
it's
bill,
not,
too?
Perovich. It's not just, Senator, it's not just the fees. It's also the whole idea that the Minnesota DNR has decided to say, okay, let's get this worked out and let's make the tournament. There's not a lot of consistency at times with some of the tournaments in the past where you'd have one regional fisheries director would say, okay, we're going to do it this way if you went up to Bemidji, but if you went to Grand Rapids, it would be different because it's a different regional director. This bill will help us put some continuity in the system, and that's what they're looking for.
Would that be, perhaps this is for Senator Chaudhry, would that be some of that streamlining, which sounds like it needs to happen, would that be occur under the best practices certification, or where is that going to occur in this legislation, Senator Chaudhry?
Senator Chaudhry. Chair, Senator Sieben, I think probably the online system that we're trying to move towards in this bill is one of the consistencies in it, so that it all can be viewed, it can all can be measured, applied to for very easily. I think having something. The current system, and it's not to cast a dispersion on any one person, it can be a little mysterious. And when we set it online, we set put a process online for the permitting. There is some consistency to it. We lower the fees. We institute best practices. It shows that not only is Minnesota serious about tournament fishing, but it's friendly to it. But also we've put this forward with some semblance of coherence and intent and mission with our tournaments. And I think that's where it's coming from. It's that attitude that we are serious about allowing this activity. We're serious about the process for it, and we're serious about our conservation practices.
Mr. Chair and Senator Chaudhry, certainly from the testimony agree that there needs to be some streamlining of the process, and maybe the DNR can clarify then how this web-based permit application process will do that. But it seems like we might need more guidance to the DNR than if there are these problems than just saying they shall establish a web-based permit application process. If we really want to get there,
Chair,
to make it more transparent.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sieben, I agree. These are some of the proposals that we've been able to agree upon amongst the angling community to put forward. And could there be more additional proposals? Of course. And we will hear from the DNR.
Senator Chaudhry, it's getting late. Let's hear from the guy to my left. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman and Committee. My name is Peter Perovich, and I am the State Tournament Director for BASS and the Minnesota Federation. I oversee and administer over 200 tournaments a year in the state of Minnesota. I also oversee the largest fishing tournament in Minnesota for open water. So I do have a little bit of responsibility toward what happens in the tournament community. I think with this bill and what we are looking at, and I guess a lot of my concerns are just, you know, some things we'd like to change, remove, add that already exist in the bill. One of the big concerns that we have is the charitable exemption that now exists. In 2008, we had 99 fishing tournaments, open water, that were exempt from permit fees. And by eliminating that exemption, the DNR will be able to collect an additional $21,000 at the at the conservative cost of $120 per tournament. That is one thing that we really, really would like to see go forward. The overall costs and what was brought in to get up to that $108,000 threshold that they're talking about that they needed. I think with the reduced fees cut in half, the charitable exemption eliminated, and if you want to compare apples to apples, if we use 362 open water tournaments, and I'm not counting the ice fishing tournaments now, this is just open water alone. There was 167 small, 195 large. With the fees cut in half, the exemption taken away for charitable, we're talking a difference in revenue of $595 less. That's all we're talking about with as far as the fees go. And the charitable exemption that is now in place is being horribly abused. We know this. And this is something that I guess that we've been talking about at the Bass Federation for quite a while that we would like to see eliminated.
Questions?
I see Mr. Petrel has come back, and welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee. Thanks again for allowing me to testify again here today. Again, for the record, I'm Brian Petrel, president for Land O'Lakes Bow Fishing Association, and had an opportunity to meet these gentlemen and work with them, and it's been a great opportunity. One of the things that we have sought with regards to the permit, the contest permit system, is an exemption for rough fish tournaments. Currently, Wisconsin has an exemption for their rough fish tournament contests. And we feel that we also should seek an exemption for a couple reasons. Number one, we do provide what we feel is a service to Minnesota waters. And also, the Minnesota taxpayers do not spend any amount of money on the management of rough fish other than the eradication of. So you don't see a gar stocking program. You don't see bullhead or dogfish management programs. So the taxpayers are obviously the only money that they're spending towards rough fish is the eradication of. So we feel that our tournaments and the permit system as it currently sits is a hardship for us. Believe it or not, we don't command the money like bass or walleye tournaments. Believe it or not, people aren't willing to spend $500 on an entry fee to provide a service of harvesting rough fish.
I believe you.
thank you.
Well, they might, Mr. Chair, if the city of Minneapolis has a $20,000 purse for the tournament on Lake Nokomis.
If Senator Dibble hasn't gotten the hint by now, Senator Schott, he's not going to.
I'm
going to
get in touch with the chamber, Mr. Chair. They've got to whip up $30,000 up in Alexandria or wherever that was.
Yeah. And so, you know, we like to use our tournaments as a platform. And we talked earlier about getting information out. And as the group is becoming stronger and bigger, we are utilizing our tournaments to reach out to people. Because part of our tournament system is we have X amount of number of people are members, and then we also allow non-members to participate so we can reach out to non-members. And we talk about laws. We talk about etiquette. We talk about the right way to fish and bow fish and the wrong ways to do it. So we like to use ours as a learning tool to reach out to people. This year, we actually applied for a permit. We paid our $120. On top of the $120, we also, Stearns County requires us to obtain the insurance. That cost us, we get that through the BA at $75. So it's costing us $195 to run the state shoot. The money that we keep from the tournament, we are hoping to break even. So, and the rest of the money is then dispersed through through awards or, you know, whatnot of prizes and such.
That's good. We're sold.
Okay.
We're sold.
Okay. Thank you.
Questions
very much
for Mr. Petrel. Mr. Pyre, did you want to give the DNR's perspective on where we're headed here? We're not headed. I don't know, but
thank you, back. Mr. Chairman, members. Ron Pyre, DNR Fisheries. And we've worked with these tournament sponsors for quite a while, and it's not a secret. Minnesota is extremely conservative in how we've managed tournaments over the years, and that's a reflection of stakeholders. A lot of our anglers view tournaments as a commercial entity, and a lot of our regulations have reflected that. But our general philosophy was kind of hands-off. The tournament sponsors were managing themselves. But as we got into the 80s and 90s and the number of tournaments started growing, we had an increasing number of complaints from non-tournament anglers that tried to get to a lake, and it's not hundreds of lakes, but it's dozens of lakes, where every weekend there was a tournament there. And so I'm trying to take the grandkids down there. And so we try to accommodate the interests of everybody, the anglers and non-anglers. And Mr. Wagner referenced it was a long and tedious process we went through. But the Minnesota Sport Fishing Congress at that time brought 100 folks together, anglers and tournament sponsors, and crafted kind of the foundation of what's here now for tournament rules. We've modified those, and we're trying to allocate tournaments based on the size of the tournaments and the size of the lakes, and we're trying to leave a couple of weekends open without a permitted tournament so that anglers, non-tournament anglers, have a pretty good opportunity to go there. So that's just a little bit of
background. Mr. Pyre, to that last comment, and I just hope that the anglers in the room hear that there are times when that lake should be available to others, and I think that's a fair approach.
Mr. Chair,
it's also fair to say, Mr. Chair, that these fees that we're talking about were only established 2 years ago.
That's true.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, I think the two main issues that we're concerned about as an agency, and it's reflective of the stakeholders, the well-being of the fish that are released from tournaments. And so we're promulgating some rules now, and part of that's incorporated in the law where we're looking at best management practices. And to alleviate the congestion at the accesses, those are the two prime issues on what we've tried to address. The fees were recommended by the Fisheries Funding Citizens Oversight Committee and endorsed by the Budget Oversight Committee, recommending that we recover costs for administering the fishing tournaments, and that came to the legislature. The fees that are in there now, the legislature asked us to put a cap on the fees, and those caps essentially were designed to recover the cost. To Mr. Wagner's point that 51 different people coded time, it's not a surprise to me. We have 28 area offices, 4 regional offices, and central office, And as these permit applications come in, there will be a clerical staff and a specialist or the area supervisor that will review that just to make sure that, we're on track. So as it, maybe just quickly to go through the bill and some of the concerns that we would have. I think going from participants to boats is fine. I think that makes sense. The congestion at the accesses is primarily related to boats. Going to 25 boats or less, though, for the threshold, we believe is going to lead us right back into the issue of access congestion and anti-tournament sentiment that was probably the most pervasive suite of calls I received for a decade. People were really concerned about that. So that threshold issue is one that we believe will drive some issues again. We will start seeing that simply because a lot of tournaments with 40 or 50 people won't be permitted and they'll be showing up at these lakes. We won't be able to distribute that pressure.
Mr. Chair, one correction. I don't think we're exempting from permits. Is that correct?
Yeah, you're saying without a permit. Yeah, if it's less than 25 boats, so okay. You would exempt. Right.
Mr. Kanoff? Right.
That was a discussion we had considered.
Right. Okay.
Sorry.
That's all right. Mr. Pyre?
We move into the waiver for charitable. The entire fee structure, we're concerned with the complexity and the issues around fees. We've already dropped by about 90 tournaments permits that have been applied for in addition to the charitable exemptions. And again, our fear is we're going to circle back into the problem that drove us to regulating in the first place because we would just as soon minimize that. So while the charitable exemption is fine, that language that would indicate that recovering the cost of issuing the permit, I don't think we're going to be able to do that, and I know there's some disagreement with that. By reducing the fees, I'm not sure that that statement would be attainable. We would just need to say, here's the fees. In terms of the best practice certification, many of these groups already have some pretty sophisticated mechanisms on how to handle fish, and we'd be glad to work with them and get the information out. I'm not sure about a certification program and the time it would take and the implementation of that, but we'd certainly be willing to work with them and discuss getting that information out, which we believe would benefit not only tournament anglers, but anglers in general as they figured out how to handle their fish. The commissioner on page 3 or line 3.28, the commissioner shall develop an online web-based fishing contest application. We think that that would be fine. We've had some lengthy discussions with Wisconsin. They still require applicants to mail in the fees, so there's going to be a separate letter with the check unless we would get into credit cards. Permits are mailed back to the applicants. Applicants can still opt to use a paper application. So their assessment at this point in time is that it's a customer service issue. It makes it easier, and we certainly could start adding to a database, and we're willing to pursue that. Wisconsin has said they would share that database. I just wanted to make the point here is that it's probably not going to reduce the costs. That's Wisconsin's experience. We're probably still going to have comparable costs. I would be concerned also about the effective date, and it will cost, regardless of whether or not we can use Wisconsin funds, there will be some costs in programming on our web.
Mr. Pyre, that effective date on line 30 of page 2, is that the one, March 1st of 2011? Is that the one you're concerned about?
Mr. Chairman, no, it would be on line 3.28 on the development of an online web-based permit application process, just to give us enough time to work with Wisconsin, work out the bugs, get it in, and finance getting that onto our web. So I'm not sure by August 1st, which is normally what would kick in, would be workable for us. I don't know that for sure, but that's something we should be conscious of. On the last piece, the commissioner shall allow for live release weigh-ins at public accesses. That's a pretty broad statement that would allow any tournament basically to go in and do their live release weigh-ins. We do allow that now through special event permits. We have some federal aid concerns. We get federal aid reimbursement, or we've received federal aid reimbursement for public accesses. The federal government has said you have to leave those accesses open for the general public. We prefer you don't have tournaments. You prefer you don't have weigh-ins. But we want the states to have some flexibility to do that, and we believe that our laws have tried to accommodate a balance between tournament, non-tournament utilization. The problem, I believe, and it's a real problem for these folks, is primarily in Metro. Minnetonka would be an example with two public accesses, both purchased with federal aid reimbursement, and the staff is not issuing the special event permits on those waters. We need to sit down and try to figure out, is there a way on some of those accesses to accommodate that?
Mr. Chair, the reason why we have this provision in there is because if you take weigh-ins, if you don't do weigh-ins at the access right there, then you end up killing way more fish. So we want to do that right there on site so you can weigh them and get them back in the water. If you're taking them off, if you have a prohibition of doing these weigh-ins at the accesses, then you're forced to take them off-site, and that leads to increased mortality.
Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see line 4.1 here on page 4 addresses the hours. What is the average time allowed by the DNR for a tournament?
Mr. Pryor.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebretson, generally we try to start sometime after 6 in the morning. I want to say, and maybe some of the tournament folks remember that, I'm thinking it's generally about an 8-hour block.
Yeah, it's about 8 hours.
7 or 8,
sometimes 9 to 3. That's roundabout, and sometimes they're shorter. But 8 would be the longest, in my estimation, for one day. It's on the outside, yeah.
Other questions? Mr. Pyre, did
Mr.
you have more testimony?
Chairman, I just had a couple points in terms of why we selected the 30 participants, and if we went to 15 boats, that would be fine. There was some rationale. We did a survey in the 90s of the average size of the tournaments at that point in time, and it ranged 25 to 30 participants. The public accesses we have generally have 20 or less slips. And so it was just kind of an intuitive. It's not a perfect number, but that 30 participants kind of addressed getting most of the Wednesday night tournaments out of needing a permit, as well as trying to address what the capacity is with most of our accesses. And just quickly, the last point I'd make is to Senator Chaudhry's point that if we don't have the on-site weigh-ins at the public access, we'll have increased mortality. Most of the tournament sponsors find a resort or some other place. It's certainly a convenience at a public access, but if you're releasing the fish on the water, the mortality would be the same whether it was at a public access or somewhere else. We try to restrict in our new rules, which we've worked very carefully with many of the folks in the back of the room here, we'll try to address off-site weigh-ins and put some restrictions on those, so some guidance on those so that we minimize mortality. That's what I had, Mr. Chairman, members. Thank you so much for allowing this much time this late.
Thank you. Senator Kielash.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm curious as to whether or not the DNR, I imagine that the permits are requested on a lot of the same lakes. There's popular lakes that are Mille Lacs, et cetera, that are asked for permits every weekend and probably during the week. And then there's other lakes that the DNR probably would say that it could handle more fishing pressure, and maybe a tournament should be on that lake, or it'd be a fitting for a lake. Are you doing anything proactive on that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kielash, that's exactly right. Where the heaviest tournament pressure is, there's probably 3 or 4 dozen lakes that are most desirable based on size and species. So we've tried to accommodate the outstate by working with parking permits. If it's a September permit on a northern lake where there's just not going to be competition, we'll be more liberal on what the allowance is there. We haven't, as an agency, went out and promoted tournaments in a fashion. We've tried to work with them, but we haven't gone.
Sarah Kielash, to your question, there are spacing requirements. You can't have a tournament on a particular lake mm-hmm. too close together in time. Is it 3 months?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Senator Chaudhry.
There's a two-week period of time that has to space each tournament on a lake. And one of the things that we want, that we see an advantage of on this online system is, like they do in Wisconsin, an applicant can see where the current tournaments are. And so they can plug in and perhaps choose a different lake for which they would be better eligible to have it. It's a lot more streamlined. It's right, it's right there. You don't have to call. You don't have to discuss. We have to call back, play phone tag, get the applications and permit fees and all of that. So we really want to streamline the system. And it will take the pressure off of the DNR staff to not have to do as much. Now, they will have to. There might be site visits, et cetera. It would be much more streamlined.
Mr. Chair, Senator Chaudhry, I think you missed my point a little bit, and that is that the DNR knows what's going on in a lot of lakes around the state, and they know that they've got a few dozen lakes that are constantly being fished, but they also know that there's probably a way to spread out the number of lakes that are eligible. There are lakes that could handle a fishing tournament or two during the course of the summer that maybe the fishing groups are less likely to use, and in fact, then we spread the number of tournaments to a broader number of lakes is what my point was. And I just asked if the DNR has been proactive in that and trying to figure out how to accommodate more tournaments by expanding the number of lakes that are available to the tournaments or promoting them to as possible tournament lakes.
Mr. Pyre?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kielash, to that point, we have, where there's heavy competition on lakes, work with sponsors to suggest alternate lakes where they could move that tournament. In terms of, have we gone out and said, here are lakes that are available if you want tournaments, we haven't done that.
Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair, I'll try to be brief, but I'm wondering, Mr. Pyre, if you could address the issue of how the commissioner of DNR now can waive a fee for a charitable organization. Are you doing this in the case of, is the DNR doing this for all charitable organizations? Or do you have any, it seems like you have discretion, and to me it seems like we may want to keep that exemption or that allowance so the commissioner has the authority to exempt a charitable organization. I assume if they are abusing it, like one of the testifiers said, then in the future if they come to apply, you would not need to exempt them from the fee.
Mr. Pyre.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sieben. One of the things we wanted to do is not have to chase down every tournament sponsor and find out if they were charitable. So we use the benchmark of 501c or if they're on the Attorney General's list of charitable organizations. And if they could provide documentation that they were on one of those lists, then we would exempt them from the fees. We wanted to be as simple as we could so we didn't spend more time monitoring tournaments. That's been an issue. It's been a controversial issue. I think what we're seeing mostly is, as Mr. Perovich mentioned, is folks are nesting under an existing 501c, so they will be a tournament sponsor that will go to an organization that's a 501c, get a name there, and say, we're part of this organization and therefore exempt.
So that's why you're okay with this change?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sieben, I think in terms of being okay with the change, in our initial bill, when we came in with the fees, we hadn't proposed any exemptions. Our calculations were going to be based on all tournaments. The legislature felt that it would be desirable to exempt charitable. I think from the fee standpoint, recovering part of the cost is what we were provided guidance for by the oversight committees and the legislature, but in our minds it's more important to address the issues that we're dealing with right now in terms of access, congestion, taking care of the fish. So the dollars, that's why I didn't comment a lot on whether the fees were reduced to a great extent.
Follow-up, Senator Sieben.
And, Mr. Pyer, I would assume that on lines 2.1, where it says the commissioner shall charge a fee for the permit that recovers the cost of issuing the permit and of monitoring the activities allowed by the permit, that seems to indicate to me that some of the recovery of your fees right now not only goes to the actual issuing of the permit, but also for your officers who monitor the are actually on the lake monitoring the tournament, or am I incorrect?
Mr. Parr.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sieben, I believe most of the costs that we built in here were for fisheries staff and then department overhead, just the extrapolation of having an agency overseeing. There's those overhead costs. I see Mr. Colonel Conrad left, but I don't believe that the fees were designed to address the enforcement cost.
Other questions? Thank you, Mr. Pyer. Appreciate your time and patience tonight. Senator Chaudhry, you get last word here.
Thank you. Thank you for your patience tonight.
You want to lay this one on the... With that, Senator Chaudhry lays Senate File 1968 over for possible inclusion. Members, thanks for staying. Staff, thanks. And witnesses, thanks for spending the day with us. We are adjourned.
Coming up, I'm going to bring 39.